solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
The fact that as AI becomes stronger and stronger, as it is becoming, we, and therefore leaders too, will need to become more and more human. We will not win over AI or thrive in the age of AI by becoming more like AI. Okay, we don't stand a chance. Okay, frankly. Okay, the only way we stand a chance is to be what AI will not be, which is more human. And so therefore that means that the things which made you human, like curiosity, okay, like passion, empathy, even love, okay, humor, okay, collaboration, working with people, eye contact, okay, is going to actually become more important than it ever was. Unfortunately, our education system and our corporate systems are super well made to take this away from us, to make us more like automatons.
Welcome to the next conversation at the Play to Potential podcast, a series of reflective conversations on leadership, transitions, careers, and life. A podcast which brings together a combination of insights from local journeys and global wisdom. I'm your host, Deepak Jayaraman. My why is to help people to play to their potential through my coaching, podcasting, and writing. You can learn more about my work at playtopotential.com. That's PlayToPotential.com. As you might have noticed, we took a bit of a break from new guests at the podcast for the last few months in terms of new content, as I was tied with my first book with Penguin, also titled Play to Potential. That's now a national bestseller. In the book, I lay out the idea of looking at potential in a holistic sense across the various domains of our life, through the pulls and pressures of midlife, and through the various seasons and transitions. Do look it up on Amazon if this piques your curiosity. My guest this time is Jaspreet Bindra, founder of AI and Beyond. He's the author of the book Tech Whisperer that came out in 2019, and he's just come out with another book, Winning with AI, published with Penguin in June 2025. He's one of the leading thinkers in the field of AI in India. I must confess, we recorded this conversation a while before he published this book. Since we had a few other projects in the pipeline, we had a bit of a time lag in publishing it. In this conversation, we speak about AI, its implications on jobs, careers, parenting, coaching, and much, much more. Without further ado, let's dive into the conversation with Jaspreet Bindra. Jaspreet, thank you so much for your time. Really excited to have you at the Play to Potential podcast. And in a way, for a period of time since I was writing the book, I was focusing on connecting the dots. So it's lovely to have you as the first guest as I get back to collecting more dots at the podcast. So thank you.
I'm honored to be your first guest, and it was wonderful to meet where we met, and I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Lovely. And we will spend the bulk of our time just be talking about AI and its implications to our careers, leadership, and so on. But in this podcast, I'm curious about people's journey in transitions. Let's first start with just describing what you do, right? What does your pie chart of time and attention look like? Can you talk to us about what you do now?
Sure.
As things stand.
Sure, I definitely will. But you know, I completely agree. I think whenever I talk about AI, I also say that it's good to start with humans first.
Yes. Yes.
And then we can get to the AI part. Okay, so let's not forget that.
Yes.
But it's interesting you mentioned the pie chart. You know, I had a corporate career, like I guess you did, many of us did, but I walked away from it about 6 or 7 years back. And today, if I was to describe, you know, my working day in a sense, first of all 7 days fuse into this work-life fusion in some sense. Okay, there's no such concept now of work-life balance and weekends, etc. But my working day, a portion of it, which is about 30%, I would like it to be 50,
okay,
is spent on creative pursuits. So it'll be either writing something or learning or thinking of new, visualizing new stuff, or, you know, I'm in the process of writing my new book.
Oh, are you? Wow.
Yeah,
okay.
So we can talk about that
later. Lovely. Lovely.
So, you know, a lot of time, not as much as I would like.
Mm-hmm.
I had envisaged that about 50% of my time should be, minimum should be spent on that. But I think it's more like a third.
Okay.
Another third, in a sense, would be spent on, you know, current business, in a sense. So I do two things. One is just, for want of any other word, a thought leadership practice, which goes under Jasprit Bindra's name. And there's a bunch of writing, speaking, teaching, which happens there. But also there are advisory clients and there's keynote speaking, which comes under that. And so when I say whether it's preparing for these things or working with current clients, etc., is another third of the pie chart, very roughly. And the last third is a new property/company that I'm building along with a co-founder, Anuj, in Bangalore. Which is AI and beyond, which is in the area of what we call AI literacy. And I will not bore you with what AI literacy is right now until you ask me.
Okay.
That's something which we are building up. It's already running. It's revenue positive.
Mm-hmm.
But since it's new, it takes disproportionate time right now. So about 35% to 40% of time is in that. So I think those are the three big buckets.
Lovely. And that's, maybe just to understand the third piece, that's advisory or is it creating products which...
No. Neither, actually. It's services, but not advisory. So so just to unpack that a little bit, I have been writing a lot about the fact that the definition of literacy will change from reading, writing, arithmetic to reading, writing, arithmetic, and how we will work innately, naturally, instinctively with AI and AI tools. We as natural as reading, writing, arithmetic, and literally, I believe that you will not be literate if you don't know how to do that. And so we've created AI and Beyond with a mission to build AI literacy in organizations and beyond. And what that means is basically what we do are these 3-4 hour, what we call boot camps, focused towards an organization where, you know, the management, usually senior middle management, learns experientially how to use it. So for most people, AI equals ChatGPT and they don't even know how to use that. Okay, there's so much more, and you know, they realize that they, with those 3-4 hours, and that's it, because it's literacy, it's not training, they realize they can save, get another 1-1.5 hour of time to do stuff. More importantly, and maybe a little perversely, they also realize that they don't need to hire as many people as they thought they would want. They would. And so it's more that.
Got it.
Tripping for these, etc. Business development for these.
Got it.
Though right now it's all word of mouth. So yeah.
Got it. And back to the book. Curious, what are you curious about in the context of the book?
The book is about AI literacy. Actually, We coined the word AI literacy. It didn't exist. But then obviously there are people now much bigger than us, big companies like Gartner, etc., which have caught on. Okay. And they are now also talking. People think differently about what it is.
Right.
But so everyone used to talk fluency, training, upskilling. But the fact that it's as basic as this was not. And so we decided, you know, the only best way to, one, to own the word, frankly, to own the term. But more importantly, also because we've done about a dozen and a half, about 18, 20 boot camps across different companies now in the last 6-7 months. And we realized it's big. Okay. And so we want to, but just 2-3 of us are not going to be able to make everyone literate by just keeping on doing boot camp after boot camp after boot camp. And so therefore the book is around AI literacy, and it's a, as I joke with people, it's not a book which the Booker Prize jury is going to stand up and look at with great admiration, okay?
Got it.
Nor the Nobel Prize for that matter.
Got it.
It's a very simple...
But it solves a key need.
it's also key need, it's a how-to. And
understood.
It's the first time I've ever written a how-to.
Which goes beyond the bandwidth of Jaspreet, I guess, right? How to add scale.
Yeah, exactly. So Jaspreet and Anuj, we've co-authored
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
Jaspreet, Anuj, and a bunch of AI tools.
Mm.
You have to eat your own dog food. If you're telling people that you can right. do so much stuff with X or Y or Z, you cannot not use them. And that's how we finished it in, frankly, world record time.
Got it.
And we have a mainline. We were keen to have a mainline publisher.
Right.
The only problem was that publishers would say, yes, we will crash the time to 6 months. You know, you've published a book. Yes. You know how long it takes.
Yes.
And we were like, we have a mainline publisher who's promised to do it in two.
Wow. Okay.
So June, it should come out.
Lovely. I look forward to that. Just staying with your journey, Jaspreet, I'm curious about how people evolve, right? And I feel very often, even in my coaching work, sometimes the cues lie in childhood.
Absolutely.
But I want to go back to your 15 years. And I'm curious, in what ways has your, if I may use a tech term, your operating system that got formed in the first 15 years, how's that shaped who you are today?
Vijay, I'm so glad you're asking me this question because no one asks this, first of all. Second is, actually, I have an answer for this.
Lovely.
Okay. And it's something I realized. So, you know, if you were to Google me, search for me before this whole, my new avatar or my late life avatar is doing all this work in AI and other technologies, you would have found me, my recognition in this world was that I was this very good, if I may say so, quizzer. So I used to quiz a lot when it was my consuming passion.
Interesting.
I was a nerd.
This is school days, huh?
School, went on to college.
Okay.
And early corporate days also. So it started in school, you know, during the teenage years.
So why are you into this whole Bonvita quiz contest?
Bonvita, yes, but we had no access to it. Okay. So we used to see it. Okay. But it was school, college quizzing, you know.
Right.
And frankly, then winning everything in sight. And that was the only way, you know, people knew me. I mean, I wouldn't play sports, etc. And so it was a big thing for me. I mean, I was consumed by knowledge. And then I discovered, beyond knowledge, I discovered trivia.
Right.
Which was even better. And then, you know, I won a bunch of things, including at that time, there used to be something on the brand equity quiz.
Right.
Which was more during my early corporate years after college. And then I started in college. I used to organize quizzes, etc. And anyway, and then, you know, I won brand equity nationally thrice. So Derek wow. O'Brien still acknowledges me as the person who's won the quiz the most.
This is individual or the team?
As a team in companies. But I was the only common factor in all those Understood. Three teams.
Understood.
And regionally a few times. But what quizzing did was the OS. So my OS really was quizzing.
Interesting.
It's not like, you know, many tech people, you will say, oh, I discovered computer and BASIC and C++ when I was 7 years old or whatever. Okay. And I was this prodigy who didn't know. No, I was none of that. Okay. So mine was quizzing. And so quizzing basically gave me this unsufferable reputation of a Mr. Know-it-all.
Hmm.
Okay. And I was insufferable. But as I tell people, I used to know all the trivial things. I learned nothing useful. Because I would do only trivia. Now, if you read all my writing today, or when I go speak, or when I, the thing which draws people to me is that, you know, so for example, when I wrote my first book, The Tech Whisperer, you know, it starts with the concept of the Hindu Trinity, Vishnu, Brahma, Mahesh, and then it goes into details of Vishnu and then how Vishnu is actually this part of digital transformation and Mahesh or Shiva is the destruction part and therefore is culture, etc. You'll find these different aspects. So Norse mythology will come in from somewhere in something else, I say. Mm. Or, you know, something which from politics, from philosophy, from history. All of that is coming because of my quizzing and is actually making all my content, frankly, different from the content that gets produced. And I've learned that people love it.
Hmm.
Okay, they love these kind of things. And so I tell people that all those years that I thought I wasted, though I won a lot of things. At a point of time, all the brown and white goods of my house were because of quizzing. My first two foreign trips ever were because of quizzing.
Wow. That deep, huh?
I know, the winnings from it.
Yeah.
Very deep, but beyond that, now, actually, I'm making my career out of leveraging that knowledge which I gained, and it's deep-seated in me. So that's actually very clearly.
It's very interesting. I use the word know-it-all, right? I came across Satya Nadella at some point.
The learn it all bit.
Learn it all. So in a way...
I told you I know it all. So he said I learn it all.
So in a way, while you framed it as know it all, quizzing requires to sort of learn it all, right? Actually, that's the real...
Absolutely. Muscle. And so, absolutely. And so I've reframed it also. So what you exactly said, I tell people I'm not a Mr. Know It All, but I'm now become an insufferable learn it all.
That's exactly right. Yeah. That's exactly right.
And this, anyway, this learning it all is why I left corporate life, which I'm sure we'll talk about later. So.
I want to move to some of the transitions you've been through, Jaspreet. You spent about 22 years across TAS, Microsoft and Mahindra's. And then I would say, if I may use the term, you've been voyaging across different things you've been doing. I'm curious about people's guiding principles, right? Talk to us a little bit about maybe just at the point of, let's say, coming away from the rails, structured rails of a corporate career. And then just maybe... How did you, I mean, eventually just taking that plunge can be hard for a lot of people. And post that, what's been, if I may say, what's been the wind around which you've been sailing?
Sure. So it is hard. Okay, it's hard, very hard for people. But the reasons for it being hard are very different. And I'll come to that. Most of us think that the reasons are about money, the salary at the end of whatever. Okay. But that's not the thing, and that's part of the... But the reason I could do it is because I tried once and it didn't work. And so after Microsoft, when I left Microsoft, actually a friend of mine, Kunal Bajaj, whom we spoke about, and I decided to set up something together. Mm-hmm. And then due to a set of personal circumstances in both our lives, we, and the fact that whatever we had set up wasn't working, okay, we kind of put tail between our legs, you know, when to do other stuff, regular stuff. And so that learnings from that first part really helped me when I took the plunge again.
Hmm.
And the two things, which were my North Stars guiding principles, whatever, the following. One is that I realized that if you take this kind of plunge, if you've planned stuff out, it isn't going to work to that plan at all. Okay. And that can be very uncomfortable for people who have spent the last 22 years of their life working to plans. Okay. And making them work. And so this time when I took the plunge, I was very clear and I published it and it kind of went a little viral, was that I talked about what I call flipping the donut.
Mm-hmm.
And my whole deal was to put it, to kind of make it, to summarize it, was that, you know, we in corporate life, we learn to earn.
Mm.
We don't learn for learning's sake.
Mm.
Okay, so if there's a donut and if you're the big central hole is the earning one, and there's a thin layer of learning around it, which is to support that internal, that earning thing. So you go for training programs, you go for this corporate executive maturity, whatever. Okay. I wanted to flip that on that, which basically says that most of my time and whatever will be spent in the learning part. And there'll be a thin layer of earning to support that learning.
Very interesting.
And I've not been true to it always, but largely, and I've been true to it. Even today, what I'm doing is I'm stuck between this, you know, I don't scale stuff too much because if I start scaling, then, you know, then I deviate from here. And that's a big disappointment for many people. So that's one bit. The second is what I realized, and I know you know him. Actually, Ravi Venkatesan told me this. I didn't believe him at that time, but, you know, but, and Ravi had hired me at Microsoft and he continues to remain a difficult mentor, etc.
We need those people.
Yeah.
We need those.
Yeah. So, and you know what I realized also as a part of his guidance, and I realized it myself also, is that what stops you from taking this plunge, frankly, is not the money part. Though, you know, you don't have to have made your money and done it. And even if you've made it, it doesn't mean that you will do something like this or, you know, a structured life or corporate perks or whatever. It's basically your ego.
Hmm.
Okay. Basically, your identity is tied to your corporate identity. You have no identity of your own.
Very true.
Okay. And
you will start from the foothills, right? Very often.
Yeah. Many, many years back, as a part of the, in the first 10 years of those 22 years that you spoke about, I was dragged kicking and screaming to a 6-day, very soft skills, HR kind of camp with, which was not up my street at all. A kind of HR based, soft skill based, knowing your own self kind of thing based training program in Goa. And again, to long story, again, I've written about it, but long story short, we were all in a room and each one was asked to introduce themselves. And they said, I'm Jaspreet from Tata, I'm Deepak from McKinsey, I'm Anuradha from Microsoft, I'm whatever. And one guy at the end said, I'm Sachin. And he didn't say anything else. And we thought he was a loser. Okay, we kept on trying to ask him, okay, Sachin, what else? And he said, what else what? So what do you do? And he said, I look after my daughter. Okay, something similar. And we're like, what a loser. But it turned out he was the facilitator. We didn't know. And he told us that, look, all of you are, frankly, identity eunuchs. Okay, you have no identity. Your identity is tied to your corporate identity. And that's when it was an epiphanic moment. And I started building, I started writing, I started doing stuff. So when I left, I had an identity. Okay. Unlike most people who do not, and therefore they are bereft. And their ego, when they are at, the banks don't give you loans and you're standing at the immigration and instead of saying, I'm Jaspreet Bindra, regional director of Microsoft, you have to just say Jaspreet Bindra who does some stuff. And so those were my, and therefore I'd kind of gotten this identity thing kind of nailed. And so that's what helped, those two things helped me take the plunge.
This is your host Deepak Jayaraman. Like Jaspreet says, identity is a big piece of the puzzle when it comes to transitions. Very often, we tie our identity to our professional title, but we all are much more than that. One of the interesting pieces of insight I would like to share here comes from James Clear, author of the book Atomic Habits. He speaks about keeping our identity small as we transition into a new context.
I think identity is a huge factor in life, but also particularly tied to our habits. So, let's think about this from a big picture level first. So you have identities that can build you up. For example, like I'm the type of person who reads a lot, or I'm the type of person who finishes workouts, or I'm the type of person who finishes where I start. And then you also have identities that hold you back. So, you know, something like I'm terrible with directions, or I'm bad at remembering people's names, or I have a sweet tooth, or I'm bad at math. And we are all a collection of identities. Like they're all multiple things that are part of you. Like you might say, I'm a dad and a brother and a neighbor and a volunteer and a teacher or whatever. And but it's not just labels that are part of your identity, like dad and teacher and friend and neighbor. It's also those internal beliefs, that narrative that you assign to yourself. And the more that you let one of those beliefs take over your entire identity or kind of occupy too large of a portion, the more that you are fragile or brittle in that way. Because if you lose that one thing, then it feels like you lose your whole self. So as an example, you often hear this with people who are in the military. They might define themselves, part of their identity might be, I'm a soldier, right? I'm a good soldier. And then once they leave the military, suddenly they're not that anymore. And so there's this like loss of identity. There's this sense of self that they feel like they lose. On a similar level, I felt that when I stopped playing sports. For like 20 years, a big part of my identity was I am an athlete. And then all of a sudden, 1 year, that was the final time I played. And then I wake up the next day and what, am I not an athlete anymore? That's like who I was defining myself as. So I think one way to get around this is that you can focus on the more enduring aspects of a particular identity that you can take with you or carry with you into a new context. So, for example, in the soldier's case, they could say, well, rather than assigning the identity, I'm a soldier, I could assign identities like I am reliable, or I'm a good teammate, or I have the back of those around me. Well, that's something, even once you're not a soldier, you can come back into the workforce or go to a business, you can still be reliable and be a good teammate and so on. Same way for athletes. They could say something like, you know, I'm the type of person who trains my body hard, or I'm consistent and show up to work each day. And like, you can do those things as an athlete, you can do those things as an individual. So part of that is the separating of the identity, or the defining it in a better way. But the other aspect of this, and this is the part that you referenced with Paul Graham's quote, keep your identity small, is that the tighter you cling to any individual identity, the harder it becomes to grow beyond it. So you see this in pretty much any area of life. The tighter you cling to the idea that, you know, like a teacher who's been teaching for 20 years and they have their lesson plans figured out, it's like, this is the way it is. The tighter you cling to that, the harder it becomes to grow beyond that, learn new, different learning methods, new learning modalities, change your course structure, et cetera. The surgeon who is like, this is the way we do the operation, even though there might be a new technology that allows them to do it in a less invasive manner. The tighter you cling to that previous identity, the harder it becomes to grow beyond it. And this is one of the real challenges for building habits, which is that early on, building a new identity is a really valuable thing because it can get you to stick to the habit. So for example, let's say that you're not fit right now, but you want to start getting in shape. Building the identity of I am a runner is a really valuable way to get you to stick to the habit of running. But then what happens, you know, 20 years from now, if you injure your knee or your hip and it's not possible for you to run anymore? Well, now you feel like, yeah, you've lost this sense of self. And so you need to transition to a new identity. And so the process here is not like a line. It's much more like a circle. You're continually evolving, continually updating and expanding and revising your beliefs. And you really need to be committed to doing that. And if you can keep your identity small, it makes that process easier because you're it's like retouching a painting. If your identity is so large that it consumes everything about you, then all of a sudden getting rid of that aspect feels like you're, you know, tearing yourself in two. And so for all of those reasons, keeping your identity small can be a valuable way to continue to grow, evolve, and expand.
If you wish to go deeper into this topic, you can look up the episode Connecting the Dots, Identity, on Spotify, Apple Podcast, or anywhere else you consume this podcast content. Play to Potential podcast members can also access 25 plus short form nuggets on identity from multiple speakers at playtopotential.com. That's PlayToPotential.com. Let's now get back to the conversation with Jaspreet. The other piece I'm curious about, Jaspreet, which I think stands out for you, is I noticed that you're very intentional about how you've gone about building your, if I may use the personal brand.
Sure, right? Sure.
It's a term that gets bandied around.
Mm.
But I think it's, there are many people who do gimmicky things, but I see that you've sort of, there's depth and intent. So can you talk a little bit about how you've thought about it?
So again,
over a period of time. And in a way, it looks like you've been thinking about it even before you left.
So I told you, from that epiphanic moment.
Very interesting.
Okay. Actually, I should have said that here. But anyway, it doesn't matter. You can draw it from there. Since then, I didn't know this concept of personal brand.
Of course.
All I wanted was an identity.
Mm.
Okay, that I should be known as this, not this from X.
Mm.
Or this working there. Or this of something.
Okay? Tied to something.
Huh? Tied to something. So, without knowing that it basically would create a personal brand. And this was at the turn of the century. Okay, so around 2000 when I'm talking about. And so since then I started just expressing my, I mean, like writing stuff or speaking in places or a little bit of teaching here and there, and it gradually built up. But two things. One, Deepak, I believe that every one of us will need to have a personal brand, irrespective of where we work or what we do. And I think a bunch of people are realizing that, okay? The way they're going about it is a different matter. But, you know, a bunch of people are realizing that. And there is a simple reason for that. I firmly believe that going forward, and AI will come into this going forward, is that this concept of one organization, many employees is going to change to one employee, many organizations. It's going to reverse, okay? So you've seen the redoubtable Elon Musk do that at that level, okay?
Yep.
No one in the Valley works for one company. It's one person, multiple companies, not one company, multiple people. And if that is so, you have to think of yourself like a corporation, as like, because if you have to be working in different places, they should be knowing you and, you know, what you do, etc., rather than subsuming your identity in one organization and just the rest of you're in that silo and no one knows anything about you. They only know about your organization. So therefore, that's one reason. That's the big reason. But the second bit that you, so that's one principle, if it may. Okay. And the second thing is interesting. See, you talked about the depth, the gimmicks, etc. Frankly, a lot of people are disappointed that I don't do those gimmicks.
Mm.
Okay. And that I operate at the depth that I do. And I've been told innumerable times that why you operate at a certain depth and or a certain height, okay, from an intellectual viewpoint, the world is dumb.
Mm.
Okay. The world has been made dumb by social media. They only like memes and emojis and
quick stuff, right?
Yeah, quick stuff. And you do this very well. You would realize this is true. And so there's so often I've been told to dumb down and I'm pointed at people. I won't name those people. But people who are intelligent, who have dumbed themselves to down, written very dumb books, okay, and
gone mass.
And gone mass, and they earn 10 times what I do, okay. And so, sure, there's, but I am not doing this to, you know, to become like an icon or an influencer or whatever. I'm doing this because this is what I like doing. And frankly, then I've realized that I've carved my own position, therefore. And so I think the first bit that I said is therefore it's necessary to build a personal identity. I call it identity rather than a brand.
Interesting.
Okay. And the second is if all of us dumb ourselves down as we are doing in most of it, then you will become one of the many. So you should have a voice which is true to yourself. Even if it means that for the longest time, you'll not be earning the kind of money if you had sold your soul or your voice in that sense. So those are the, true. That's how my things here, principles. Here.
And the other piece, and I'll get to this, I'd love to explore this one company, many people flipping the other way around.
Yeah.
Like flipping the donut.
Yeah, yeah. This is the triangle being flipped.
Flipping the firm. Before we go there, I'm curious also about a long game. You've been doing this for a while, Jaspreet, and I think I figured you just wrote your 150th column for the
movie. Yeah, yeah.
So congrats on the 150.
Thank you very much.
I'm curious about a long game mindset because I find the other thing that's happening also is sort of in a way miniaturization of stints and innings. So I've developed, I have a certain sense of respect for people who play the long game because anything takes time to compound. Right? Identity, reputation, expertise, whatever. So talk to us a little bit about how you've thought about that.
So I never thought about it until people started asking me, oh, you've built a personal brand and personal whatever. Tell us how to do that. I said, look, I'll tell you how to start. 20 years later, you might have it.
Hmm.
Okay. So, and then they basically go away. Because everyone wants like it to happen tomorrow.
True.
And one way to do that is go into Shark Tank and suddenly you'll have it. But the Shark Tank guys also built stuff for 25 years before they got into Shark Tank.
True.
But the world doesn't see that. Okay. Exactly. The world sees that last thing that made it happen. Okay?
Correct.
And so they think that it's an overnight thing. So, yes, therefore it's a long game. But frankly, I didn't think of it as a long game. In fact, I didn't even think of it as a game. Okay. I was just putting my voice out there and my whatever I could think of out there. I was writing, speaking, teaching, as I told you. And I found that what I was good at, what people said I was good at was demystifying complex stuff related to technology, making it understandable and more importantly, making it interesting.
Hmm.
Okay. And so the tech whisperer came out of that, you know, the elephant whisperer, dog whisperer, you know, speaking their language and therefore the tech whisperer. I never thought of it as something which I need to do. Okay, now let me make a 20-year plan or a 25-year plan. And, you know, I'll kind of plodding around. I'll keep on doing it this way rather than trying to do gimmicky stuff that you said. So in many ways, the answer is very similar, Deepak, to the one which I gave before, that you you won't actually even know what you're good at. You have to be out there and then you'll discover it. Okay. And once you discover it,
it's emerging.
You have to then play to those strengths or that potential in that sense.
Very true.
Rather than trying to get distracted, which I often am told to do and accused of not, of kind of playing, you know, there are these models which are shown to you in India and elsewhere saying, look, if you do it that way, then, you know, you'll be like, $10 million. There's a playbook there. Mm, mm. And sometimes I get distracted by it also, saying that, you know, what you're thinking will happen in 5 years. If you play that, it'll happen in one.
Yep.
But if it's not you, and if it's not something which you won't be able to do it.
Very true. And I think if I may, one of the people I spoke to at the podcast was a lady called Herminia Ibarra from London Business School. And she says in transitions, test and iterate as a strategy beats plan and implement.
Absolutely.
And to your point earlier about why people don't do it.
You have a bias for action. You have to just go do stuff. I've done 50 things and the thing that you see are two of them.
Very true.
The other 48 have failed. God knows how many times I've started doing a podcast and failed every time. Now I'm going to try once more.
You've got other channels which are working well.
No. But you know, I mean, it's fine, you know, because I've tried it. Right. I know what works for Dylan. I'll try it once more.
Got it.
This time when I tried, it'll probably be for the third time.
Got it. So I think back to the long game mindset, I guess you just need to stay true to yourself at some level, right? There are many playbooks available that could sort of take you on different paths.
Yeah.
But I guess we need to figure out.
Absolutely. You know, everyone can't be a Yuval Noah Harari.
Yep.
Okay. We all want to be that. Okay. Yep. But you can't be. You know, you have to just realize what you're...
True. I want to change track, Jaspreet. I want to sort of move to maybe it's a good place to start with what you said, right? The one company, many people, flipping to one person, many companies. Can you sort of maybe shine the light on what's driving that acceleration?
Decentralization. So before this AI animal became so famous, I spent a long time and I was known, after my quizzing, I was known to be this blockchain guy.
Mm.
Okay. And I have this tech talk, which made me famous, about 1.5 million plus views on demystifying blockchain. I gave it somewhere and it paid. And so I came to be known as this blockchain expert, which I wasn't, but I didn't try to change people's mind. I let them assume that. Okay. Anand Mahindra still thinks I'm a blockchain expert. But so why I'm saying all blockchain so many times to answer your question is, the reason I was super fascinated by blockchain was not because of crypto and, you know, all the other stuff which was happening around it, was because it was a decentralizing technology in a very rapidly centralizing world. Okay. And the reason blockchain hasn't succeeded, in my opinion, it hasn't, right, is because the forces of centralization are far more stronger than the forces of decentralization. And the world is even more centralized than it was, you know, 4, 5, 7. And when I say centralized, in politics, in power, in money, you know, banking, just the rich, poor, etc., etc., etc. Blockchain came as a decentralizing force. And I got far more passionate because of that. One of the things which the blockchain kind of threw up as this thing is something called digitally autonomous organizations, or DAOs, which were used for many reasons. But one of the things which DAOs started getting used for in org structures, about how they talked about the organization will become a CEO less. And by the way, many companies, including the Zappos shoes and, you know, bunches of companies experimented with DAOs, but many of them knew. And the whole deal was that organizations were created in a different era. It's like the institution of marriage. It was created for a different era and now it isn't working 50% of the time in developed countries. Okay. Similarly, organizations were created for an era when you needed that, you know, people by themselves didn't have access to resources, to information, to now that access to information, access to capital, access to talent is available in a decentralized manner. And so
think it's sort of on the cloud, right? Much more.
Exactly. Everything, all of this, everything that an organization was formed to access, those those what were called those factors of production, okay, are now available, okay? And so I question the need for massive company organizations. And that started happening. Look, it started happening with Jeff Bezos talking about two pizza teams, you know, teams small enough to kind of, you know, whatever. And now with AI agents, et cetera, like it's one pizza too many. Mm. Okay. And so as agents come in more and more, as access becomes to, and now we are getting free access to free intelligence, access to free research, you know, again, things for which organizations were necessary.
Mm.
So I believe that now we don't need those structures. And so what will happen? We'll go back to where we were. We, before organizations were there, we were free agents.
Mm.
Each person, you know, where each person was wedded to seven different companies, organizations, communes, guilds, whatever you call them. And in many ways, I think we're going to go back there. And so
it's like goes back to, if I may say, Renaissance.
Possibly.
Where you had artisans and they were commissioned to do different things by different people.
Exactly. Except that now the scale is much bigger. And so while it could work at a scale of a world population of 200 million, okay, at 8 billion, you need these structures. And these structures have come in now and these technologies have come in. And so that's the philosophical reason.
Hmm.
Okay, but the other part is that as these newer generations are coming along, the concept of earning has changed. You know, the earning concept was a salary every month. And now it is, okay, let me just slave for 10 years, sell my startup and have enough money for life to do other things. You know, so the new generation, these technologies, the new way of thinking, etc., therefore leads me to believe that, you know, the future of work, the future of organizations in many ways would be bunches of free agents coming together for specific needs, tasks, etc., like, you know, forming like a swarm and then
like a mission. Huh?
Yeah. And then another swarm and then another swarm. And I think even warfare is moving that way. So everything I think is moving to this.
Interesting.
Yeah. And that's why I believe this.
Interesting. Let's change topics, Jashreet. Sure. I'm curious about the implication of some of these developments in AI on leadership.
Sure.
I used to be a recruiter at Egon Zehnder in my past life. I'm curious, from a leadership ask perspective, what's shifting or what has shifted? You know, in this world of AI, the leader of today with access to AI, is it the same kind of traits as, let's say, maybe 20 years back? Or are there one or two that are emerging which are more relevant today than they were earlier?
Sure. Look, So there's a dichotomy here, a little bit of a dichotomy, okay? For in one sense, and therefore I don't have an exact answer, if I may put it that way, it'll emerge. But the two, you know, not opposing, but two different views here are. So one is, I firmly believe, again, I write on this, and it's not only me, the bigger people who write on this, is that it is about being human in the age of AI. It's about the fact that as AI becomes stronger and stronger, as it is becoming, we, and therefore leaders too, will need to become more and more human. We will not win over AI or thrive in the age of AI by becoming more like AI. Okay, we don't stand a chance. Okay, frankly. Okay, the only way we stand a chance is to be what AI will not be, which is more human. And so therefore that means that the things which made you human, like curiosity, okay, like passion, empathy, even love, okay, humor, okay, collaboration, working with people, eye contact, okay, is going to actually become more important than it ever was. Unfortunately, our education system and our corporate systems are super well made to take this away from us, to make us more like automatons. And remember, AI is an automaton.
I recently had a personal milestone in my family. My 12-year-old son and my 16-year-old daughter completed their Bharatanatyam Arangetram on the 21st of September 2025. And that's the equivalent of graduation in that classical art form. As I think about what being human means, I feel it is about bringing in our emotional intelligence, physical intelligence, and spiritual intelligence in a unique, authentic way to make a difference. As I witnessed their dance performance, it occurred to me that there are very few pursuits that engage the head, heart, mind, body, and soul in an integrated way. It occurred to me that not only are they learning dance, but hopefully they are building a toolkit that they can dip into in the future as they think about being more human in an attempt to be relevant in the future. On a broader note, I think there's something to be said about the arts which lets us explore our humanness and hopefully bring some of that to bear. While the world is hurtling towards STEM and computer science given developments in AI, I wonder if the machines would be better than us very soon in those departments. I feel the answer might lie in being in touch with ourselves, either through art or otherwise, and bringing that to bear. And each of these things is hard to measure, right?
It's hard to measure. Except that all you need to do is to look at a 2-year-old child.
Yep.
Okay. Some of the things which we were told when we were young, that it's not the answers that you give, it's the questions that you ask is more important. And we were like, no. In the corporate world, including in leadership, as leaders search for answers. They want answers from everyone. Answers, Deepak, in this world are going to become a commodity. Okay, answers will be all over. But the right answer will be dependent on the question you ask, what we call prompts.
Yep.
Okay, and so I think leaders will have to very radically change in that sense to become more human-like than organizational androids in some sense.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that will mean, therefore, that, you know, I believe, for example, and therefore the softer skills will be more important than the harder skills. I believe, therefore, that women will get this faster than men do.
Very interesting.
Okay.
Very interesting.
And therefore, you know, because it's that part, the human part, which as men being are raised up not to be, you know, very emotional and things like that. That's one big part of it. The second part of it is that, is again goes back to literacy. That, see, I believe that like we had digital culture, there will be a new kind of culture, which is AI culture, which is different from digital culture. And it's all about these things, these human things. It's also about working very, very closely, innately, instinctively with AI agents, AI tools, soon AI, robots, etc. DEI's definition will change to mean humans and machines working together, you know, and how that has to be managed, therefore, from a leadership perspective. And a leader is not going to be able to get it until she or he becomes AI literate. And so, you know, like culture, I believe that culture follows gravity. Okay, similarly,
what do you mean by that?
Culture it flows top down.
Understood.
Okay, never can go this
understood.
Way.
Understood.
Okay.
Understood.
And so this also, people at the top will need to get AI literate first, okay, to understand how their organizations are going to change. I'll give you a number, a report a year and a half back from Microsoft and LinkedIn talked about this concept of BYO AI.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so BYO D is bring your own device, BYOB, we all know our bottle of whatever. But BYOAI is bring your own AI.
Interesting.
80% of employees 1.5 years back across the world were bringing, younger employees were bringing their own AI to work. Okay. And this is only going to increase. And here we are as...
What does that mean in tactical terms?
It means that you...
You have access to whatever AI tool
it
you
means
want.
That your bosses have banned ChatGPT at work, but you have it anyway in your phone free and you're using it.
Understood.
Okay, bringing it to work, sneaking it in your back pocket.
Understood.
Okay, so... that and the weird part is... And here's where leadership is scared and it's saying that ban everything. Mm. Okay, until we understand it. It's like... it's not going to happen. It's not going to, you know, there's no barrier to it. And
until we understand.
Until they understand, oh, this is what it means. And this is how they can do it well and do it safely, etc. That's being AI literate. That's all literacy.
Hmm.
And they're the same people, by the way. You're a recruiter. You were a former recruiter. When I go across and I talk to many senior people, boards, etc. I do these keynotes.
Yeah.
And I'm like, will you recruit a person who cannot work with these AI tools? And the answer is unequivocally no.
Mm.
The same people who are banning it don't want people who don't use it. Okay, so that's the dichotomy. So these two things: be more human, be an AI literate human.
Got it. And just taking the AI literacy, just to make it very tactical, right? Mm. Let's say if you're a CEO today, clearly you research a lot of AI tools and models. What are the three tools you might suggest to get started, right?
So CEO is the most difficult role.
Yeah.
You know, in a company, we all know that. Okay. If you think of what are the top 2, 3, 4 things that a CEO does.
Yeah.
Okay. First of all, she or he has to absorb massive amounts of information.
Yeah.
Okay. Disparate information, not only internal, but external, competitive, geopolitics. And what has that has meant? That basically means that a CEO needs to basically have 72 hours in a day and multiplied by 1,000 days in a year to absorb even some part of it. Okay. Now, many of these tools actually help you absorb information much faster, distill. Okay. And so Notebook LM, for example, which many people don't use, can create brilliant podcasts out of, you know, something out of 10 different research reports which are out there. So you hear it on the way.
Interesting.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so you give it print and it gives you a podcast to listen.
Yeah, yeah. And unbelievable. Okay. It's just, you know, you and your IS podcasters are out of job very soon.
Hmm. We should talk about that separately.
For example, what do people do today? They put stuff in ChatGPT, summarize this article. That's the most useless way of using AI. Okay. Is this for me? No, there are 100, it can create mind maps for you, amazing mind maps for you, which you keep on going into. So absorbing information. Second, what is a CEO? A CEO communication is a big, big deal, right? Many ways, communication on email, for example. A CEO might get 100, 150 emails, 200 emails a day. I'm sure some of the staff can handle some of it, but actually using voice features of ChatGPT and others, you can pretty much answer 50% of your emails on your way to work in about 1 hour. The voice feature. People don't use the voice feature of ChatGPT. It will help you frame with the right tonality, etc. And it'll know you very soon as to what you kind of write. By the time you're there in your draft folders, there's like 20 replies sitting there, which you then just polish and send off. You know, something as simple as, but in communication, if you're a CEO of a 300,000 person company and you want to welcome each employee with your own voice, with your own, and about the employee, you come from here, this is what your job is going to be, and you know, you'll be great at it because you did this. You have amazing personalization tools from 11 labs or smallest.ai in the CEO's voice, which can welcome every employee who comes in. It's as simple as that. Mass customization. We do this in our boot camps. People just stand up from their chairs. Okay. That's number two. Number three is research. Okay. And, if, for example, as a bank and strategy, okay, as a bank, you want to figure out what should be your next 5-year strategy and be like JP Morgan, okay? And how can AI help you do that? And what is JP Morgan? You usually would be, to do this, you will be kind of paying several $100,000 or maybe more, okay, to a bunch of consultants. Deep research tools from 4 different providers, and they're called deep research for a reason, can actually do this, and with the right way, with the right prompts, with the right way of conversing, can do this in a few hours. Okay. And, you know, do about 80% of the stuff for you. And after that, the humans come in and you don't need all those highly paid humans. So I've just thrown 2, 3 different things, but there are multiple other things that at a CEO level or a CXO level, just offsites, you know, a large, getting people together to brainstorm. You can actually use AI as a very effective second brain or a third brain, which is not a human brain, but will give you perspectives. If you, Sam Altman or one of these guys tweeted recently, that when he talks to what he does and when he talks to people of his level, what do they use these tools for? The number one thing actually is brainstorming and sounding board.
Wow.
Yeah. Which CEOs, as you know, need a lot.
Of course. I remember talking to Vishy Anand on my podcast.
Mm.
And one of the themes we explored was this whole man plus machine.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Given machines are coming in the world of chess as well, have been around for
a while. Oh, it's been around for a long
time. Deep blue.
In fact, there's no man versus machine there now.
Man plus machine versus man.
Machine has done it.
Correct.
Anyway, yeah.
The point he said was machines often bring out an edge case, which is often beyond the realm of comprehension of man.
Yeah.
And even in brainstorming, I'm guessing there's a certain way in which our mind works, and sometimes
absolutely,
machine throws up things which are way beyond
wait.
What we can.
And look, we have one brain. We have one brain. This has been trained on data and ideas of billions of brains.
Yeah.
So it can. And chess is very interesting. I mean, people say that, for example, I mean, today Vishy Anand or Garry Kasparov or even what's his name now, the big.
Magnus Carlsen
plays 100 games of chess with a chess AI, or not even an AI, with a chess whatever. They're going to lose 100 out of 100 times.
Hmm.
And so in one way you would think that chess is over, but on the other hand, chess is actually far more popular after AI came in than it was before.
Hmm.
And so it's interesting, and I think that's a direction which is going to go. And so on this, you know, a lot of times I think AI should not be called artificial intelligence.
Hmm.
Should be augmented intelligence. And a lot of people talk about that. And I think a lot of these tools help you augment your intelligence rather than, I sometimes believe even alternative intelligence is a better term than artificial intelligence.
Just to maybe closer home, Jaspreet, as we think about the impact of AI on professions, right? Let's say coaching. You know, once hearing trends about chatbots that are playing the role of counselors, coaches, etc. What's the, you know, this is a selfish question, right?
Sure.
What's the lesson for people in this space? And I'm asking the broader question, counselors, coaches, sounding boards, people that are playing this role, how do we have to stay relevant?
Sure.
Do we have, just like man is, machine has beaten man in the world of chess?
Yeah, will the machine beat?
Yeah. What's your forecast?
No, future? Absolutely. Look, I think professions like this, high touch professions, these are high touch professions, are actually the safest professions in many ways, okay? Because, you know, when you're coaching or when you're even doing a keynote speech or when you're counseling, guiding, it's not just the words you say, okay? It's the tonality, it's the empathy, it's the all those human qualities that I spoke about are as if not more valued by the coachee. Not just here are three suggestions, or it's the questions you ask or whatever, okay? So I think these professions, in my opinion, these more, you know, there's some excellent stuff that Kai-Fu Lee, the Chinese AI guru, has written on this in terms of these kind of jobs which have very high compassion or love actually as a part of the job. Okay. And you can think of love or compassion in different ways. It's not just romantic love or whatever. But, and there's a big but. This, to continue to be successful in this, you need to work with AI. You need to get in AI as a co-coach, if it may. Okay. Because one of the things I'm very fond of saying is that it's not AI which will take your job. It's a human being using AI who will. And this is true for everything. Hard professions like being a software engineer, if you're a coder who doesn't use GitHub Copilot or Cursor or Replit or one of these, you know, a coder or a software guy who uses it is going to beat you hollow. You're jobless. Similarly for a marketeer, similarly for any of these professions, including a coach. So you're in danger if you're not co-working with, if you are, then you'll be like a super coach. And the people who are not are the ones who are going to suffer.
Interesting. This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman.
It's worth going back to the conversation with the chess legend Vishy Anand and hearing what he has to say about the role of machines and how we can work with them.
I'll make this analogy. Machines have become like incredibly fast cars.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say the best chess players are like athletes, which means that the athlete in its best ever moment is not going to be have a slightest chance against a very fast car. Mm-hmm. Now imagine that advanced chess once upon a time was two athletes getting into their cars, being able to use their car and being able to intervene themselves when they felt it would help. Now, this would only work if your fuel was insufficient for the entire ride and a certain portion had to be driven. And what happens now is that man plus machine versus man plus machine is just often machine versus machine. There's very little, it's very hard to know when your intervention is better than the machine. And it's so infrequent that it's hard to pick out. And the point is, you may decide that your intervention is crucial, but if your rival is still using the machine, then you have to be sure that your human touch is not worse than what it's going to do. So that has turned out to be a dead end. However, chess has become spectacularly enriched by our ability to work with a machine at home and combine its ability to throw up unusual patterns, unusual ideas. I mean, one of the things that's forgotten sometimes is how rich chess seems now, because the machine has shown us how many things we had rejected which turned out to be possible.
Very interesting.
And how many areas we thought were closed forever have opened up again. I mean, if the machine is guilty of closing doors, it's responsible for opening far more doors than it's closed. And right now, it's a golden time in terms of how rich the game seems. And the other thing it's done is it's made chess accessible to everyone, because if anyone has the world's best coach, if a slightly not very talk expressive one, then every person on the planet has the world's best coach available for a price. And that means that once you know how to ask the right questions, you can get the right answers and you can grow. So the learning process has become incredibly interesting.
In a recent coaching context, I used Notebook LM from Google to read my notes and come up with some coaching pathways for a coaching client of mine, a general partner in a venture capital firm. It came up with three or four ideas. I already had a couple on my mind, but one or two were interesting angles that I hadn't thought of earlier. Like Vishy says, I think AI opens up interesting pathways that are often in our blind spot. So if we work with it, I think the augmented intelligence can be quite powerful. Let's now get back to the conversation with Jaspreet. Another term I came across recently, Jaspreet, was as machines become smarter. I heard one somebody say, we need to double down on our humanness. And the phrase they used which stayed with me was, what's your alpha above the baseline LLM? You know, just like we talk about alpha in stocks. The question being, what's your alpha above the baseline LLM? What's your
no? So all the things that it's the same thing. It's about being human in the age of AI. It's the things which
that's AI, the alpha.
That's the alpha or the delta or whatever it is. Okay, so it's your human abilities, and it's your human abilities to not only to, you know, to be curious, ask the right questions, and even human connection. Human connection is severely miss. Is underestimated. Okay, I mean, I go give my keynotes, for example, and people pay me for it. And I'm like, you know, whatever I am telling you today, you can actually so if I'm talking for an hour, in 1 hour, you know, ChatGPT plus Gemini plus Google plus blah can tell you 10x more than this, you know, free. But you still wanted a human to come and tell you because you don't do it. I mean, that's why e-learning as a concept failed. Those MOOCs as a concept, okay, because the human connection is absolutely and will continue to be the alpha. And human connection can be has multiple components.
I want to move to careers, Jaspreet. You know, as we look 5 years out, 10 years out, what's your take on the class of jobs that are going to get created? And the class of jobs that are likely to perish. Of course, there's a bunch of jobs where
we need to augment ourselves using AI, like you just said.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I'm curious about the extremes here.
No, so look, this thing is moving so fast that my answer changes every week. I continue to get amazed by, before ChatGPT brought its new image feature last week, I never thought that graphic designers would be in so much trouble as they are now. Okay. So you really can't predict. The only thing I would say is I look upon it in four ways. The first is that certain number of jobs are not going to exist. Differing estimates, dependent on who you believe, between 10% to 25%. And every technology which has come has decimated jobs. So this is going to be perhaps a little bit more. Okay, so it's now. And so what, if you're mostly jobs which are either low skill, you're summarizing stuff, you're doing just basic research of something, or you're kind of, you're doing payroll software, okay, or whatever, it's not going to exist. There's certain jobs which nothing will change. Okay, they'll continue to exist. So if you're a farmer, you're absolutely safe. Okay, or if you're a construction worker.
I guess it's a knowledge worker that's...
Though, there's a evolution of AI, which sometimes is called physical AI or called... there's another word for it, which I forget. Which might...
Interesting.
But, before that. Those are roughly about 30-35% of jobs. Nothing is going to happen. Okay. The third is very interesting. Third and fourth are more interesting than the first and second. The third is every technology has created more jobs than it has destroyed, period. Every single technology. And in every technology, we were this afraid of losing jobs. At that time, computers, automobiles, whatever. But the thing is, we don't know what are those jobs which are going to be created. Which basically, you didn't know there'll be online reputation managers or search engine marketeers before the internet or search came in. And that's why, again, literacy. You'll need to, when they emerge, you will need to be ready for them. Mm-hmm. Okay. And that's why you need to know, how to work with these things, because jobs are going to emerge out of that. How much percent? We don't know, because we don't know the number. But the last is the most critical, and many people say that's going to be between 50 to 60% are the jobs which are going to be impacted. And that's where what I spoke earlier, anyone using AI will be better, will take the job of someone not using AI in whatever job it might be, whatever. And so those are the four different ways you kind of look at it. And which are those? Many people, again, Kai-Fu Lee, whom I quoted, has this beautiful matrix, and he's given 10 specific jobs which will be like never hit by AI, in fact, will be the jobs of the future. CEO is one of them, for example, by the way. Okay. It's different.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman. Given what Jaspreet says, I guess all of us need to develop an entrepreneurial mindset as we move into the future. Whether we choose entrepreneurship as a profession or not, that mindset is likely to be useful. I spoke to Ravi Venkatesan, who's one of the leading thinkers in the realm of how we stay relevant given AI and some of the other developments.
Look, the world is going through a period where the supply of jobs will not be able to keep pace with the demand for jobs. Okay. Partly because jobs are, as a construct, as an industrial thing, which is going away as companies want more fluid contracts. And also we are doing a better job educating larger numbers of people. So the supply side is increasing handily. So if this supply-demand gap is not short-term, but actually structural and long-term, then what you want to do is get more people becoming entrepreneurs and both to feed themselves as well as maybe create livelihoods for a few more. And of course, in some parts of the world, entrepreneurship is flourishing. In our own country, it's doing very well in some of the larger cities like Bangalore or Gurgaon. But the question is, how do you, is it possible to catalyze this so it spreads like wildfire to our smaller cities, towns, and rural India? So that's the whole purpose of game. And our work is to try and, you know, make it aspirational, get more people to think about this as a conscious choice and number one or two on their choices rather than a government job. And then how do you help them think about an idea and incubate it, and how do you create an environment that promotes growth, so on and so forth. That's what we're trying to do in game. But along the way, we've realized that, look, while not everybody may want to be an entrepreneur or capable of being an entrepreneur, in a very, very fast-changing 21st century, everybody needs an entrepreneurial mindset. Okay, it doesn't matter what you're going to do, but the chances are, if you have an entrepreneurial mindset, you'll be more successful. Now, what is it about the entrepreneur's mindset? I think there are four or five things. One is, they're able to sense opportunity. Every problem to an entrepreneur is an opportunity in disguise. Okay. To somebody else, every opportunity is a problem. So you want to help people make the shift. So if there's garbage lying on the streets, it's an opportunity for a waste business. Okay. Climate change is the mother of all opportunities. So get them to sense and see opportunity and then act on something that moves them. So that's one aspect of an entrepreneurial mindset. A second one is this idea of resources versus resourcefulness. Don't get crushed by the fact that you don't have resources to start with. How do you bootstrap yourself is a very powerful idea. So for instance, somebody may have an engineering degree from not a particularly good college. They can't find a job. Okay. If you have this bootstrap mentality, you'll say, look, I don't mind starting out as a Swiggy delivery person. Okay. But that's not where I'm going to end my life. That's just how I'm going to get going and bootstrap myself. And then in the off hours, I'm going to do something else. And then, so that's why I point out that this mindset is very crucial. Problem solving is another thing that every entrepreneur has to do. Every day there are new problems and you better figure out how to solve them fast. That's pretty handy in life as well. Tenacity, not giving up, staying with it till you encounter success is another attribute. So what we're saying is every person will benefit and be more successful if they have some of these mindset and skills. And we found that it's teachable.
Creatively skill stacking our various capabilities and going on a talent market dating process to discern how we can contribute to the world around us is a skill that's likely to be even more critical in the future. I discussed this approach in greater detail in my book, Play to Potential, that I published in November 2024. You can find the book on Amazon, the print version, Kindle, or Audible, whatever works for you. Let's now get back to the conversation with Jaspreet. Moving to careers, right? My father worked in one company for 40 years. I worked in three before I moved to portfolio. You worked in a few, three, four, five.
Yeah.
How do you see careers playing out in the world of AI?
We've already spoken a little about this, okay? Because, see, think about it. Every revolution democratized something. So the agricultural revolution created an abundance of food, which never used to exist before. Changed the world. I mean, you can't imagine how much the agricultural revolution changed us as a species.
Yeah.
Okay. The industrial revolution democratized labor. Okay. Changed everything. How we lived, where we lived, what we did, jobs, work, society, marriage, everything. Okay. And then a little further down, the information revolution kind of made information free. Again, created this in organizations and careers. So if, there's been great work done on this by different people, but, as this changed, organizations changed. Okay. They started with this so-called red organizations, which were command and control. Okay. Army, church, no performance appraisals. Okay. Tribes. And then with the Industrial Revolution, you started having organizations, again, hierarchies, etc. And careers changed, therefore. And our parents were in that.
And then we were on the cusp of this and the information revolution. And here it was different. 20% of your time is your own time. Okay, you're kind of more a free agent than you used to be. Moonlighting is happening. Okay, more newer startups are happening. So you move jobs more often. Entrepreneurial stuff is happening. And now intelligence is going to become free, which is crazy. Intelligence on tap. Okay. And when that happens, we'll see a different kind of careers. In fact, I don't think they'll be called careers any longer. And that's where I believe this thing of what we spoke earlier, which is about one company, many organizations. So I think at the most extreme, each person will be a free agent. Okay. With the specific set of skills, so much available on tap. Okay. And kind of, you know, using that too. And actually, you see a lot of the younger generation, even in India, okay, getting into that mode, okay, where a reasonable portion of a batch which graduates is not running after the placement list, okay, but actually saying, you know what, I'm going to do graphic design for someone, plus this, plus learn something here, plus use these AI tools to, you know, deliver something. Or go on Fiverr or TaskRabbit or
whatever. The portfolio was after 10, 15 years.
Right now, it's going to start from the beginning.
Day zero.
Yeah.
Many of them are sort of.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
it's a natural evolution from lifelong jobs to 10-year jobs to, you know, during the internet era, 3-year, 4-year jobs, okay, or 2-year jobs to virtually few month jobs, but except that they're not jobs, but or few weeks, but they are tasks which you're doing. The whole swarm thing again is how I think it's going to go.
Changing track completely, Jaspreet. I have a 15-year-old, I have an 11-year-old. As parents, how should we think about raising children that can stay relevant and happy, if I may add that term as well, given human connection is also.
So, I think that the kids, and I teach, I don't have kids myself, okay, but I teach a few of them. Many of them actually get it more than the parents do, okay, or the teachers do, very frankly. I think what do parents worry about? One is staying relevant, the other is safety of all these new things. I personally think, and if a parent of a 15-year-old, 12-year-old boy, girl comes to me and says, can she or he use ChatGPT? I'm like, absolutely, just keep her away from Instagram. What I'm trying to say is that that social media is actually a much bigger problem than AI is from the protection fear viewpoint. And I personally think that if a child gets far more enamored with these new tools of AI, it's a much more healthier obsession than being enamored with Instagram or whatever. Okay, so that's one way to guide them to this newer, shinier toy. In that sense, it's a comparatively a safer toy. Okay, then I also think that a lot of human connection has been lost again because of social media. Okay, not because of AI. AI helped it, make those attention happen and clicks happen, etc., etc. But I would actively, as a parent, yank my child away from school which banned AI.
Interesting.
Because you are setting them up for failure. Okay. Remember, the people who are learning how to work with it, okay, are going to be far more equipped than you. It's like you not knowing the internet and going into the world, or many years back, you not knowing what Microsoft Excel is and going out into the corporate world. So I think, in my view, parents need to play a much more proactively supportive role to this. And again, as much as possible, trying to raise them as good human beings will mean that they will use AI also responsibly. But the worst thing as a parent you can do is to actually ban or
them out,
limit a person, a child from doing that, and try and that 4 hours of Instagram time can be much better used, because there's so much. It's like you know, we used to get fascinated with Encyclopedia Britannica or whatever, okay? And so, I mean, my limited, because I'm not a parent myself, I have limited things to say here.
Sure. Got it. Just last couple of questions before we wrap up, Jaspreet. One is just for professionals in general, right? This question of staying relevant. See, I think we all, given advances in healthcare, will live longer and therefore possibly be productive for much longer. What's your take on staying?
Let me tell you, give you a very provocative thing here. Not only is this a technology which favors cognitive over our menial or white collar over blue collar, it favors the old over the young.
Interesting.
Same. I'll tell you why. And this is a sad story, but it'll bear out. You know, what are the skills which AI is good at? It's good at the skills which an employee does in the first 5 to 10 years of her corporate life. Okay. Paralegals, researchers, market research, graphic design. Okay. Following up, minutes of meeting, summarizations.
Yeah, it sort of leads to hollowing out.
Exactly.
Off the bottom layers. Right?
And that is very dangerous. Okay. And so what happens? And there's a very interesting article in New York Times which talks. And so, okay. And what is it that AI cannot do? The experience, the learned memory of organizations, you know, the judgment. Okay. Things like that.
The higher order skills. Huh?
Higher order skills, which you develop in those 10 to 15 years. And then you kind of become what you become. And so it favors the old over the young. Okay. The lot of stuff which quote unquote younger people will do, it is not, I won't generalize, but is now being. And so this very interesting New York Times article, which has really struck me, is that therefore what happens? And this lady who wrote it, I forget her name, said that we'll probably have to go back to the apprentice system of old. You know, in the olden times, once your child reached a particular age, you decide, if he has an interest or you want him to become an ironsmith, you would go to an ironsmith, a master ironsmith, and say, please take him as an apprentice.
Like a good,
pay you. I will pay you for the 2 years that you teach him. Today, organizations pay you to teach you. Earlier on, that wasn't true. You paid to learn. Will we go back to that? Maybe. Okay. So, therefore, I believe that, I mean, this is the darker side of it, but let's come to the lighter side of it. And therefore, for people of a certain age, say above 35, 40, 45, 50, you know, I think this technology is made for them. Okay, right. All the things which required lots of energy, lots of, detailed work to be done, etc., while you could use your, on top of which you could use your higher orders.
You've got leverage. It gives you nice leverage, right?
I do it all the time. I'm that age. You know, and I do it all the time. I don't have any researcher because deep research does more work than any researcher would. Okay. Or it is sad in the other side. Okay.
The paradox here, however, is if we have that hollowing out where we have the senior people, let's say the more evolved, experienced people leveraging ChatGPTs, how do we create a pipeline of talent that bubbles up to the
top? I agree. Look, I think in a sense, it's an extreme situation.
Yes.
I don't think it's going to happen that way. But certainly, there'll be an impact. Okay? Certainly, there'll be an impact.
Interesting.
And so, I don't know the answer to that hollowing out. I don't think it'll be fully hollowed out. Thinning out.
There is... thinning out is the right word.
Yeah, maybe thinning out.
Right.
And that's a societal issue in that sense. But I was answering your limited question of older people.
Fair. Okay. As we wrap up, Jaspreet, as you know, the podcast is titled Play to Potential.
Yeah.
So given just your vantage point through which you look at life, what's your take on playing to potential as we look ahead?
So I think in many ways, the way you've led the questions and the podcast is actually playing to play to potential. Okay. but you started with, you know, me discovering what is that my potential is. And I think that some people are lucky. They know it early. Bill Gates knew it like when he was 11 years old or whatever. Okay, therefore he could do stuff which
Tiger Woods gave it when he was three.
Or sorry, his
Tiger Woods' father sort of got him started when Tiger he was Woods. Three.
Right? Demis Hassabis at four, you know, was a chess prodigy and he figured out stuff and whatever. Anyway, so some people are lucky they figure out, but I think the first is to know. When you're saying play to potential, there's a word here between two and potential, which is your potential.
Very true.
Okay. And
it's very individual.
So first you need to figure out what is your potential. Okay. Mm. And that is a discovery thing. Okay. And it's not going to happen unless you experiment with a bunch of things. And it's not going to happen until you're curious about it. People aren't even curious about it. They don't care.
Mm.
Okay. And so first is that. And then the second is that you have to play to it. So in the sense that, again, what we spoke about, that, you know, you don't try to be someone else. Okay. To be just because, you know, there's a model, as you said, or there are other people who are in that particular potential area doing better than you or whatever.
Mm.
And then the third, if I may add, is that now you've got some phenomenal technology tools out there. Okay. Once you realize your potential and once you are set, know that you want to play to it, don't do it alone. Okay. So you've got like this amazing set of tools out there, technologies out there, which can just totally catalyze, turbocharge your journey, you know. And I'm doing that now, but I wish I had this 5-8 years back. You know, I would be at a very different place than what I am now. Okay, if I had this
fascinating
force behind me. So I think those are the three things.
Fascinating. Thank you so much, Jaspreet. Pleasure talking to you.
Same here. Brilliant talking. Thank you so much.
I hope you found the conversation useful. To dig into our work, consider visiting playtopotential.com. That's playtopotential.com. Members can access curated insights by theme. If you're a CEO or a CHRO of a company, you might find that this piece is useful in the context of sharing resources with individuals in line with their development needs. You might also find the book Play to Potential, published by Penguin, relevant. In the book, I discuss how we can think about playing to our potential in a holistic sense. Thank you for listening and look forward to having you tune into the subsequent conversations and the podcast. Bye now.